Welcome back to America Trends Podcast. I'm John Krofczyk, sitting in for Larry Rifkin today. And that's because I'm interviewing him.
How unusual is this show?
Yeah, I know.
We've
turned the tables. But you have a fabulous book called No Dead Air. And it's a wonderful read. I tell you, people should get it. It's really a great read. And
Well, thank you, John. And by the way, the check should clear, the one that I wrote for you to say that. No, I really appreciate that from you. And I just want to say, you haven't heard John a lot lately because we have been in the COVID routine and I've been doing the opens and all. But I want to let you know how important John is to this podcast. He gets it all together technically, really makes it all sound great. And I can't thank you enough for being the partner.
It's a lot of fun. We're having a great fun.
No, we are. And I think we're bringing great content, but I couldn't do it without John. I say that literally, not figuratively.
Well, let's get down to your book.
All right. Well, the book is out, by the way, on Amazon. And, I would hope that anybody who listens to the podcast would, you know, check it out.
Yeah, I hope they do. It's a great read. I tell you again, you get it.
And John read the whole thing. At least he tells me that. Because there are no cliff notes. So John must have read the whole thing.
Anyhow, I want to talk about you worked in radio as a kid, and then you moved to television. So I want to know, I mean, that's quite a jump. TV is a completely different animal. Now, what was that like coming from radio to TV?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because it is different. However, I think people of a certain age, and I'm of that certain age right now, though I think my voice belies that, but I am 69 years old. And if you read the book, you'll know that. And the point is that we all came out of radio, those of us who went into television at a certain age. Today, that's not the case. And today, of course, people are doing all their own video. But in my time, that was a very normal course of events. For me, I think what's most interesting, and I hope comes through in the book, it was never certain, John, that I was going to be in radio or TV. It was never a sure thing. And as I point out in the book, I had doubts all along the way as to whether I was ever in the right place, whether I really belonged, what I knew and didn't know about the industry, what role I could play meaningfully. And I was very fortunate that somehow I was able to carve a career path that really allowed me to have fun and really create some pretty interesting stuff along the way. But I never was assured of that.
Well, it's kind of funny that you know, reading your book and how I've read a few of these books and how paths, you know, how paths open up for you, kind of, you know, I guess they call them God winks or whatever. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's interesting you said that about God winks, because I think I interviewed the people or had them up at CPTV who did that whole thing of God winks. But it was a husband and wife team. I'm forgetting their name. But no, you're right. There are a lot of God winks in this book.
There are.
And by the way, I said in the book that I took a very circuitous route to television. And again, I got out of radio and I was doing public relations. I was doing speech writing for the Commissioner of Education. And somehow I found my way into the public television system here in the state of Connecticut. And little did I know that when I got there, starting in public relations, later in programming, that I would have an almost 30-year run that gave me incredible experiences beyond the state of Connecticut. Even though, and I think most importantly, and I hope it comes through in the book, the thing that I cared about most, John, was the state of Connecticut. I wanted to do great programming, having an incredible editorial shop that I had to really have an impact in Connecticut. And I think the good thing is I overshot and had some national impact too.
What was it like putting those programs together? And, you know, here you are coming in, you're the new guy, right? So it must have been pretty shocking and to be able to assemble a team and get this thing going.
Well, that's a really good point, John. when I came to CBTV, I was the head of public relations. And then a new president came in at CBTV. And because I was the first person really to meet him, Jerry Franklin, we became close. And he was glad that I was able to navigate Connecticut media for him, get him appearances, let people know that he was the new guy in Connecticut. But I was not doing programming. I was doing public relations. And at a certain point, Jerry was a guy who was in a hurry. And I talk about that in the book. And he broke a few eggs to make a few omelets, let me say that. But having done that, one of the eggs that he broke was saying, I'm getting out of convention, and I think you're the guy to lead our programming effort here in Connecticut. And I said, well, I really have no background in production. He said, look, I think you know the state of Connecticut. I think you know where the stories are, and I'm going to entrust you with that. And I was like, really? And that was, again, one of those moments that you have in a career where somebody else sees something in you, pushes you forward. You may have a certain concern or reluctance, imagining that you weren't ready. But somehow he saw that, and I do have to really appreciate that from Jerry's standpoint. But I really had to deliver, because he was not somebody who, if he made a mistake, was not ready to correct it and say, hey, Larry, I gave you the chance. You blew it. Sorry. And, of course, I talk about in the book that I took over local programming in 1986, and by 1989, I had been able to develop a really open programming shop, inviting new voices in, new producers who weren't even producers, maybe because I didn't come through a traditional route, John. I was not afraid to take somebody who was a writer or somebody who was a teacher or a theater director and make them into a producer if they could tell a great story. And so in 1989, and you pointed that out when you and I talked earlier off the podcast, that was when CBTV, according to the New York Times, came of age in the Boston New England Emmy competition, where we won 5 Emmys on one night. And that was shocking, because Boston, which is the 6th largest market in the country, and Connecticut, which was then about the 25th, I mean, there was no reason for us to do that well. There's incredible talent in Boston, but we came up there and people were turning heads like, what's going on in Connecticut? And we went on to win, during the time that I was involved in local programming, about 50 or more Emmys. So, I mean, we really had our moment.
Well, you really created some wonderful programming, too. I mean, we can talk about your friend Andrew. Mm-hmm. He was an incredible guy, and I think worth mentioning here.
Well, I devoted a whole chapter to him. And I devoted chapters to people you know, like and Don Russell, Ed Flynn, friends of ours from radio. But, let me say this. I invited a lot of people into our shop because I was running an unconventional programming operation. I was doing the gig economy before anyone else because I didn't have enough money to put everybody on staff. So I was looking for a lot of independent producers. And I got a call from a guy from Boston, and he said to me, hey, I've got an idea, and I hear that you've got a pretty open shop in Connecticut, and I'd like to run this by you. And
now, was that unusual in those days?
Not really. I mean, it started opening up. The door, okay. I said one of the most important things I did was answer the phone and open the door. And it's amazing what rushes through when you show your interest in really having those ideas come forward, because we had a reputation of being a rather closed shop at one point. And a lot of media companies are like that. They don't take ideas from the outside. I recognized that I couldn't afford to have all the producers I needed on staff for the ambition that I had. Because I think what comes out early in the book, John, even at the point of talking about the telethons that I did for Easter Seals, my earlier TV experience, I was aggressive. Wherever I was ambitious, and I liked to work. And so it always came through. Even when I was at the State Department of Education, I tried to shake up that department. And you read in the book about, you know, state employees, and I had some who really wanted
to... That was
to
a very funny section, by the way.
I wanted to shake them up, and as I said, one person remained unshaken by all my pronouncements. So anyway, I guess my point is, that I wanted to achieve, and I had a burning ambition. So I thought this was the best way to do it. So at any rate, Andrew called and said, I hear you guys are doing things in Connecticut. And he was from Boston, a stringer for ABC. And he said, I have this idea. I want to hitchhike across the country.
Yeah, this is fascinating.
Yeah, and I want to do a documentary, and I want to be on camera with it. And he convinced me by the end of the call, $2,500 was what he needed, and edit time after. And thus was born Thumbs Across America. And Andrew P. Jones and I became friends for a long stretch of time. And I'll let you read the chapter in the book that describes what occurred in Andrew's life.
I don't want to give all your secrets away.
Right, right. But it's a compelling story, and one that to this day moves me when I talk about him.
And there were so many others. I mean, you produced the Flood of 55. I mean, what are some of the others you
Well, we had so many stories. My idea was this. I want to tell all the big stories in the state of Connecticut. All the big stories. Because none of the news stations were going to do that. They're focused on news, as you know, every night. So they tell a little snippet, oh, this is the 30th anniversary of the Flood of 55, and they'll show you somebody getting flooded out, and that's it. But with public television, you have the beauty and you have the authenticity of really going out and finding those stories historically, and people love that. And the Flood of 55, which Rich Hanley did, and in fact, it started with a documentary that was done by Valley Cable, my cousin, Harold Kramer, and they had done a documentary, and we thought it was great fodder, and this wasn't the documentary that we did. They did an earlier version, and we just kind of took it to the statewide level. And so, you know, we're always looking for those incredible stories. So Rich Hanley, the producer, remarkable guy, he did also the Hartford Circus Fire. He did the 1965 Little League Champions from Windsor Locks. We had Brent Musburger doing the voiceover for that. I mean, we got great talent. We even had, and I don't put this in the book, but Walter Cronkite did a series for us voicing it over on cancer. I mean, we were really lucky that we found great talent and we brought them to the topic in hand. And so in Connecticut, whether it was Mark Twain, whether it was the Wadsworth Athenaeum, any of these great institutions or persons in Connecticut, if there was a story to be told, the USS Nautilus, whatever it might be, CPTV was telling the story. And then I wanted to do some harder edge stuff, too. So we did the last interview with the last person who died on death row in Connecticut, Michael Ross. And we got access to him to interview him before he gave up his appeals. That's the only reason he actually died. And then, of course, we did one on Connecticut's drug web. So I liked gritty things. I liked things that were really in the news. I even did a whole study of the state of Connecticut called Connecticut Viewpoint that allowed us then to do programming based upon what people told us was important to them. So I tried lots of things over the years, but I also followed the PBS model. So PBS does the American experience. So what did we do? The Connecticut experience. So we did a documentary between Boston and New York. What is Connecticut? You know, we don't identify Connecticut the way Texas does the Lone Star State. So what is the identity of Connecticut? Trying to figure that out. And that's not easy, John.
No, you're right. That's not easy. We're kind of stuck in between there. We're in the same way.
Well, if I asked you to give me one word to identify the state of Connecticut, it'd be hard.
Nutmeg.
Right, nutmeg. And no one knows why, or the Constitution state. But I'm saying there's just nothing like a lobster in Maine or however you identify various states. So we did that. We did Puerto Rican passages. We did Roe v. Wade because a lot of, or the Roots of Roe was the name of the documentary, as part of this Connecticut experience with the Connecticut Humanities Council. That's the other thing I did. I looked for partners. And so we had a great intellectual force in my friend Bruce Fraser, who died just too soon at the Humanities Council. And we did about 9 or 10 documentaries with them on the Connecticut experience. So we were doing serious work here in Connecticut. And I've got to say this, because I say it in the book about public television. Public television was built on a congressional district model. If they were going to get any funding at all, and we've always been underfunded from birth, we had to have a station in every market or every congressional district to get support. Now, that model didn't really even make sense, John, when it started back in, you know, the 60s with the Public Broadcasting Act. And of course, public television comes prior to that with the National Educational Television Network, but it was reborn as PBS back in the 60s when Lyndon Johnson said, you know, I know we haven't figured out the funding model for public television, but I'm going to get to that next. And of course, he then resigned or decided not to run again. We never got a secure funding source. But you have stations all over the country, John. But I will tell you this, John, and I say this really with all humility, there were very few stations trying to do all the things we were doing for our community. Wow. But it was just, they had a very aggressive programmer who really wanted to tell these stories.
Now, do you find that you got to get funding? Now, you know, in commercial TV, you got commercials you put on. You don't want to upset the advertisers. Do you find that the same way with the PBS system, where maybe you wouldn't produce a show or you'd shy away from a show because the funders might say, we're not going to do that?
Well, yes. And John, I addressed that in the book. If you recall, what I said was we were probably more susceptible to commercial influences than commercial stations, because basically people are buying eyeballs on commercial stations. But oftentimes when they're funding something on public television, they're funding a subject matter, a program. The problem is for public television, those who would seem most likely and appropriate to fund a program may be ineligible for that reason. So, for example, if you wanted to do a show on some pharmaceutical issue, you couldn't go to, you know, any of the pharmaceutical companies because it would be a conflict of interest. So you go to somebody who's one step removed, or maybe you go to the Johnson & Johnson Foundation, or maybe you go to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, or you go to the Kaiser Permanente.
A lot of juggling to do.
Well, you have to be very careful. And don't forget, the standards that PBS applies to that kind of thing are really stringent, less so on the local level. You can be a little less stringent. However, I really wanted to avoid those conflicts, and I didn't really work a lot with our local development department to get funding for local programs. I went out and raised money with the Connecticut Humanities Council, the Connecticut Arts Commission, with the American Public Television people, who funded a whole host of programs that I talk about in the book, where we became the de facto New England chronicler. So we did Islands of New England, Lighthouses of New England, Cape Cod Reflections, yeah. Vampires of New England, because most people don't know that a lot of the myths about the vampires came about because of tuberculosis. So we were doing all kinds of things that even went beyond our borders. And that's when I began blurring the line between what's a local program, what's a national program. And Sharon Blair, who brought me into Connecticut Public Television, thank you, Sharon. She then was in national programming, and she was not somebody who really cared about the boundaries that much. She was very allowing. And so she saw Larry going off and starting to distribute some things nationally, which were really more her bailiwick, and she kind of just waved and said, come on through. And so I did. And ultimately, I took over both local and national programming at CBTV. The national programming hit that we had, and the book builds up to this, is really what will sell any of these books nationally. And that, of course, is, well, you've heard of Barney the Dinosaur.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. But before I get to that, I want to talk a little bit about music, because I know that's one of your favorite subjects. And you had a lot of musical experiences with PBS and even on your own. So I don't even know where to start. I mean,
well,
you had a band.
Yeah, if you like music, there are a lot of chapters and a lot of information about music.
Some great specials, I tell you.
We did many specials with Carole King at the Bushnell, Celia Cruz, the great Cuban artist who was legendary. Of course, Bobby Vinton, Gene Pitney, The British Invasion Returns. I got to go to South Africa for a musical, Ippie and Tombi, and I dedicated a chapter to that. So it was an incredible ride. I got to interview Ringo, and we distributed one of his programs. There's just a lot that went on there. But, of course, I start the book talking about the fact that I wanted to be a drummer, and my dad acquiesced. And by the way, the book, of course, starts talking about my dad.
Right.
And if you're wondering why the title, No Dead Air, I tell a story about my dad when I was young, and I went into his bedroom on a Sunday morning. Hey, Dad, you've got dead air. And that's the worst thing, right?
For any radio station to have dead air.
Oh, it's the worst thing. That means there's nothing on.
And then people are changing the channel.
Right. I mean, what happened to 1240? It's gone. And of course, people don't understand this, John, but it doesn't ring in a radio studio. The phone,
right.
Because it'd be ringing all day. It only blinks, and if you're asleep, you won't see that. So anyway, then I go on to tell that story. And that chapter, I think, ends with Ken Burns, and
yes.
I talk about my father.
You're right.
And Ken Burns, now, you got to see how I put that together, because they were generations apart. But anyway, with all that, music has been a constant in my life, and I started playing drums. And the dear man, Bob Mobilio, who ran the studio that I went to, my father would always say to him, Bob, is it really worth the $3 a week? And Bob, yeah, it's worth it, the kid. And I loved Eddie Montana, who was my drum instructor. And so I've been in bands all these years. I tell some pretty funny stories about how ZZ Top opened for us.
I was going to say, tell us about ZZ Top.
Well,
that must have been very exciting.
I bogarted us into a festival that takes place, I think, still annually in Chattanooga, called the Riverbend Festival. Someone came to us and said they wanted to do a documentary on unknown and known bands going to Riverbend. And, of course, the big band that year was ZZ Top. And I said, well, I have an unknown band. What about us? Wouldn't we fit the bill? And he said, well, if it would get me distribution into public television, sure, we'll do your band. And Mary Ollie Newman, one of our producers, who was helping him put it together. And so she said, yeah, let's do it here in Connecticut, you know, looking at your band as you're getting ready to go to Riverbend. And then they had to put us on, John, because they had to use us in the documentary. So we went on right after ZZ Top. Now, again, we're a little local restaurant bar band, and there we are on the B stage with 100,000 people there at 11 o'clock on a Thursday night. Of course, by the time we finished, there were about 3 people there, and I tell the funny little thing about going up the hill, and this guy goes, hey, man, you guys were great. And, you know, enough lubricant and enough whatever else, and I guess we sounded that way to him. But anyway, it was such a fun event. It really was. But music has permeated my life, and I talk at the end about how in this latter stage I took up a keyboard, and now I'm recording lots of my own music, playing piano, which I never thought I could teach myself, using pianogenius.com. Tim Gross, you're great. Thank you. You helped me do something I never thought I could do, and I'm having a ball with that at this stage.
Well, while we're talking music, I got a name drop here, because you did some great work with Harry Chapin, or for Harry Chapin, I should say, not with, but for Harry Chapin.
Yeah, we did this tribute to Harry Chapin that had been done at Carnegie Hall, and it was one of the first music shows that we really got involved with in my tenure, and we were able to take the material from that, which is called, you know, a raw tapes and raw material, and then put it together. Ken Simon was the producer, and I think we did a beautiful job on it. I mean, I'm really proud of the program. I think it's still up on YouTube, and it's really an emotional tribute to Harry, and we got people like Judy Collins and Bruce Springsteen and others to talk about Harry. And Harry was an idol of mine. I used to go see him every year, and the ability to be able to do that for him of course, posthumously meant a lot to me, but it was one of the first music deals that I did. And I talk about how you make a deal in television and how they can get complicated, particularly with music. And I tell a lot of that story when it comes to the Carole King special.
Yeah, but you know, it's, you make it so easy. I can just name drop here and you go. It's fun. We're having fun. You know, now let's get to the dinosaur in the room, because that's a biggie. Barney was a phenomenon.
Well,
I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah, and I really hope you will read the book. But as it turned out, my daughter, who was then 4, Leora, and I went into the Prospect video store. And John and I live in the same town, so it was a little video store on Route 69, Super Bowl Sunday, 1991. And Leora, who was not a big videophile, said, "Hey, Dad, I'd like this one." And it was Barney and the Backyard Gang. So something about that video, A Day at the Beach, got her attention. So I thought little of it. We took it home. And she wanted me to play it over and over. At that time, it was VHS, right, and you had to help the child and so forth. So I sat down, and I said, what's really getting the attention of a daughter who doesn't really love video, but this really has captured her imagination? And it was that focus group of one that led me the next day, on a Monday, to call Cheryl Leach, who then was creating these videos down in her father-in-law's studio off of a printing company that was really his primary business. He was starting up a video business, and evidently he had downtime, and she was creating this character. And she was having some local success, there's no question, but not what it ultimately came to be. And so I said to her, "Cheryl, have you ever thought about PBS? And she said, "PBS?" in a nice southern drawl. "Tell me." And that's how it all began. Then Connecticut Public Television and the Lions Group went to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and to PBS, and they were having a call for new children's programming to supplement Fred Rogers and Sesame Street. And I'm going to let this book tell the remainder of the story.
Yes, don't.
But it's more complicated.
It's a very interesting chapter. I found it very interesting. So let's move on. Now,
okay.
I think another great thing.
I want to say that the subtitle of the book is Career Reflections from the TV Executive Who Saved Barney the Dinosaur from Extinction.
From Extinction, yes. So let's move on to another biggie, which was something great you did, was you brought UConn basketball to CPTV. I mean, it just, who would have ever thought that, you know, women's basketball would be big on TV?
Well,
you did.
Well, let me
and
say,
it was great.
It was a lark at the beginning, and like a lot of things, I mean, John, as I talk about in the book, when I said, Lobo, L-O-B-O, out of the West comes Lobo. You know, in the state of Connecticut, we started hearing about the UConn women's team in, you know, the early 90s, but they hadn't won a championship at that point. They weren't the legend that they now are. But there was a state representative who was a real fan of the women's team, and he came to Jerry and said, "Hey, what do you guys think about airing a women's game?" And Jerry came to me and said, "Larry, what do you think?" And I said, "I don't know. Interesting idea." And it was in the middle of March of 1994. And again, they didn't win the national championship until 1995. And I said, let's roll the dice. That was kind of my nature. And again, I was thinking, everybody's seen a minute of Rebecca Lobo, but they haven't seen a whole game. And there was a myth building up around her. So it's instinct went with it. But you know, it's interesting with all these stories, because sometimes, you know, people think that bringing something to television was the most important part. But there were other pieces along the way that I considered even more important in terms of having a role in it. One was when I went on vacation right after we aired a game or two, and, you know, it gets a little hazy. But the point was that I had called back to the station, and Jerry was thinking, and others, well, we didn't raise $5,000 to air another game because the production was already in place from another site. Maybe we won't do it. And I said, let me talk to Jerry. And I said, Jerry, we've got to follow this to the end. Because I had a gut instinct that Lou Perkins, then the athletic director at UConn, wanted to know that we would be loyal. And that would mean a lot to him. You have to know Lou's personality. And I said, we don't leave this year until they lose or we lose the opportunity until it goes to CBS for the Final Four. And so we did. So we stayed with it to the end. And that wasn't a lot of games.
Right.
But it was really so critical. And the second critical thing, it was in 1996, after they had won the title, they recognized they had something of value, John. They had something that other stations might like. And Jerry got the sense from Lou that he wanted us to share it with a local commercial station. So he set me out to try to make a deal with the other commercial guys. And I came back with 2 weeks to go. And I said, you know, Jerry, my take is this. If we don't own it alone, it will lose all of its value to us. Membership, promotion, so on and so forth. And I got to give Jerry credit. He said, well, if that's what you think, let's go for it. And we went for it, and we had it for 18 years. And I say something in the book that, you know, it's not only the most successful local franchise in the history of public television by way of audience and by way of membership dollars and underwriting and just promotion, people knowing CPTV in a way they had never known us before. We were now must-see TV in the middle of the winter when people watch the most television. But it was, in my mind, the most transformative local television franchise for any station in history, because everybody's got news. But this changed our relationship with the state of Connecticut in a way that nothing else could have.
It was amazing. It was amazing.
I mean, how would you typify it, John?
It was just amazing. It was just watching the women's was really, it was fun watching the women play more so than the men, because it's a different game. It's
and
really,
don't forget,
it's more of a team game.
Television, as I say in the book, is character driven. And these young women stayed for 4 years. And Gino was our main character, Gino Auriemma, and he's never left. And so we had a character-driven program of reality television, though you generally knew how the score was going to come out.
Yes,
I will say that.
Gino.
But even when people fell asleep, John, in the third quarter, they woke up and they saw a documentary on leopards that they never would have seen, and they loved it.
That's right.
A concert by the Rolling Stones. So
They say that with radio too. If they fall asleep with you on, they're going to wake up with you.
Exactly. And a lot of people did, because the blowouts. But it was the most remarkable thing. And you see it, John, here in the state of Connecticut, when there's an obituary and someone has passed, a lot of older women, and they'll say, I love to knit, I love to garden, and I love watching UConn women's basketball.
That was a great thing.
Amazing, the transformation. As a local station, you rarely feel that love and energy. You might have good ratings and all that. We felt it, and the first time was when we were in the parade in 1995 and people yelling, I love CBTV. You know, it was just amazing. It really was.
You know, I got to mention your wife. You know, when you're out building a career, Carm, and even with my wife, you know, we leave them kind of in the dust there because you're building a career. And she was really great to stand by you. And I'm glad you put that in the book. That was
I put a really, chapter, because without my wife, Carmelita, I would never have had the ability or the freedom to do the long nights, because public television makes you a volunteer, particularly when you show a capability of pledging. So I became not only just a TV guy behind the scenes, but really,
you were on TV all the time.
Yeah, all the time. And so people think, oh, you only went into work 3 hours every other night in March and December. I said, no, that was after 9 hours at the desk. But having said that, Carmelita is her own remarkable story. I mean, you know her.
Yeah.
She is a dynamo. She's had her own career. And as I say, they could write 5 books about her. But I tried to at least let people know how important. And again, throughout this book, I try to sprinkle a lot of life lessons,
yes,
John. I try to give some industry.
There's something for everybody in this book. There really is. There's humor. There's a good story, great story. There's something for everybody.
And there's a lot of celebrity stuff, if you like celebrity stuff.
A lot of names dropping. Yes. Now, let me ask you this. How do you feel about someone going into the media today? Is this a career for them?
It's different. I mean, I don't know how easy it would be for somebody like me living in Connecticut, never going to a major media market, which I talk about in the book, to be able to find something like a Barney that ultimately becomes a cultural icon and, you know, lamppost. I don't know how easy that would be today. However, there are so many avenues today. And a lot of them are uncurated. And by that, I mean a podcast where you go into it and it's all yours and you have the freedom to say or do whatever you want. The question is, do you have the maturity? Do you have the sensibility to give people something that isn't, to some degree, not an embarrassment, but really not of a professional standard? And of course, you know, having been one of those gatekeepers, one of those curators, like even this book, John, I decided to go to Kindle Direct Publishing. And I had talked to other publishers, and one wanted the Yukon story alone. Barney's story was interesting to people, but I wanted to tell my story.
Right.
And I wanted to perhaps provide people with some confidence that really there's no one path to an end that you want. And, you know, I just read an article about retirement and the fact that so many people are not happy in retirement. And I do talk about that.
I like
at
you
the
in
end.
The book, how you, what was it, Webster's Dictionary is retirement, what was it, disappearing, I forget.
Yeah, a lot of really negative connotations. So I say that I'm casually employed, and
that's
I am
right.
With the
you
podcast.
You are working harder than ever.
With Chris Radio, with the book. And the book I'm putting out myself, I'm not using HarperCollins or what have you. And that's because I have confidence as an editorialist, which I talked about myself being, that I could put a good product together without needing that author wagging a finger at me saying, you know, this is not right to tell or whatever. And I had to do a lot of my own self-examination of what I thought. But I think I'm really honest in this book.
Oh, you are. Yeah. I mean, even your medical
issues, I talk about.
I don't want to give away all the secrets, but it's a very interesting article. And I didn't even realize how much you had gone through with that.
Yeah, it was a tough slog for a long period of time. But having said that, I think young people should feel that there are great opportunities, but don't hold yourself to a lower standard simply because you're doing it alone. Hold yourself to a very high standard, even if you're doing a podcast that 10 people are listening to outside of your home. Give it your best shot. Try to listen to others. Try to gain from their experience. I was lucky. I grew up a radio brat, as I talk about in the book. So I was able to see my father as somebody who was developing talent and was a talent on air himself and what was involved there. That didn't mean that that was then conveyed and passed down to me by any means. And I had to find my own voice on radio. I talk about my time in talk radio with you, John, as my producer.
Yeah.
And I talk about how I didn't think I belonged there either, but I built a different kind of show.
Well, you had what I forget her name is. You have grit. Grit.
Well, you know, we did a different kind of show, but I was committed to doing it my way with some integrity, not screaming, not yelling, right. Not trying to, you know, out bluff the next person. And somehow I think we had an impact in this community.
Oh,
and I
did.
Talk about that.
Both on radio and TV, you had a big impact. So, well, tell people how to get the book. How do
okay.
you get the book?
Thank you, John. And by the way, you've done a really good job. I may have to have John do a couple of the podcasts without me. And you'd probably be grateful for that. You can go on to Amazon and you can get a paperback version. I think they're $15.99. And then you could get a digital version and you could read it on Kindle for $6.99. And I hope you'll pick it up. And I hope you'll let us know what
you think.
So is
that available now?
You can go on.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
So on Amazon? Look for No Dead Air.
No Dead Air.
And you'll find out why there's no dead air.
Well, thank you for keeping this alive. And again, I can't thank John enough. He's been just the best
mutual.
Partner. And I talk about John
it's
in the book.
Great. Yeah. First time I'm in print. I saw my name in print. I'm somebody.
Well, you know what that entitles you to? buying hundreds of copies.
That's right. I liked Ed Flynn, too. You really played a good...
Well, he's a dear friend of ours, and Ed is up in his 80s now, a remarkable broadcaster. And I talk about him because he was my first program director on radio, and most people don't know that. And then I ended up, at the end of his career, taking his job. I mean, it's just a, it's an interesting twist. And by the way, I even talk about the dawn of FM. Because I talk about WWYZ.
That's right. We didn't even touch on that.
I know. And WATR, how important it's been. But look, we're boring you now.
Yes.
We don't want to bore you anymore.
So next time, we'll be back. We'll be back soon.
With a trend.
With a real trend. This is a good trend, though. I hope it keeps up.
Well, thank you, John. I really appreciate it.